This is Jim Inkster, and welcome to Talk Louisiana. Pleased you're starting your week with us. The show originates from Investar Tower in Baton Rouge, and signature support is from the Mayor's Office of East Baton Rouge Parish. Today is the 15th day of July, and 1 week from today, Phil Price, veteran attorney, one of the best-known barristers in our state, he ran for governor, you may remember, in the year of 1995 and ran a highly competitive race. He'll be leading some troops into the courtroom in a case that's been twisting and turning for more than a decade involving the Stanford Group. And as we know, many of the victims of this Ponzi scheme lived in Louisiana, and many right here in Baton Rouge. And Phil Price, good morning to you, sir.
Jim, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, Phil. Good to visit with you, and I think we got your mic in order now. But tell us about how you got involved, as I said, more than a decade ago in these cases involving hundreds of people, many of whom lost their life savings in this $5 billion Ponzi scheme.
Well, Jim, I had a client that lost a lot of money in it, and he asked me to go to this meeting at the state capitol to just hear somebody talk about it. And I went there, and it was a large meeting. It was about 400 people there, and I didn't recognize a soul. And I had somebody come up to me. In fact, it was Bodie White's sister, and said, are you representing any people in connection with Stanford? I didn't know her at the time. And I said, well, I'm really not. I have one client. And they said, well, we would like to meet with you. And I said, oh, man, I don't need any more work. And so she said, okay, I got 10 people. Then she'd call me back and tell me I got 20 people. And then she'd call me back and tell me I got 40 people. It turned out it was all the Exxon retirees, and we ended up having a meeting of about 100 people that had invested in Stanford. And it started from there up to the time that we represented in excess of 400 people. But it wasn't like we went out looking for it. It was just people didn't know what to do.
Well, the case that goes before the court next week is in East Baton Rouge Parish before Judge Don Johnson. But you also made a stab at going the federal route. You got shot down there. What happened?
Well, in the federal lawsuit, we ended up taking that case to the United States Supreme Court, if you can believe it. And the question was whether it was state law or federal law that would apply. And we won it at the United States Supreme Court, and it said that state law would apply. Well, why was that important? Because all we had to do was to prove negligence. Well, that portion of the case was against SEI as a company out of Philadelphia that performed the back office operations for Stanford. And that case ultimately was transferred to Dallas. It stayed there a little while, and then it came back to Baton Rouge, and we had it transferred here. And then Brian Jackson ended up dismissing the case, and I was somewhat surprised because I felt that they played a critical role in it, but they did dismiss it, and so that just left the Office of Financial Institutions in the case in state court, and that's what this case is about.
This will be a jury trial?
It'll be a jury trial.
And I said $5 billion. Some estimate $7 billion. This guy, Alan Stanford, he was quite a player, shall we say, and he's now in jail. But for a long time, he deceived a whole lot of people, didn't he?
Really he did that. Everybody thought he was associated with Stanford Institution on Stanford University.
Well,
on the West Coast.
When I became station manager at WRKF in 2003, they were our biggest underwriter.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's actually unbelievable. But, you know, Baton Rouge was perfectly suitable for a Ponzi scheme because he would go out and solicit one, what we call a bell cow, and then people would hear about it, and then they would follow the bell cow. And it just generated where there was close to $1 billion lost in Louisiana from that Ponzi scheme.
And many of these people worked for ExxonMobil, didn't they?
A lot of them did. Typically, what would happen is you would have somebody that was nearing retirement, and you would have to take the money out of, say, Exxon's pension plan and roll it into an IRA account. And that happened over and over. So Sanford knew that the retirees at Exxon were having to take their money out, and so they convinced them to take their money out and move it to the Stanford Trust here in Baton Rouge. And Stanford Trust is a Louisiana-regulated entity, and so over and over, the Stanford Trust set up IRA accounts for these people, brought their money into Stanford Trust, and then invested their proceeds in the Stanford International Bank CDs, which ultimately became worthless.
Well, this guy, Alan Stanford, he was born a month before you. I don't know if you know that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he was riding high, highly regarded. Pillar of the community, he had airplanes, and he spent $12 million just renovating his yacht. And he got away with this, but there are stories, and I presume them to be true, that he was under investigation going back to 1997, and that was well before this. So how was he able to dodge and weave and stay away from the long arm of the law for so long?
Well, that's one of the issues in the trial, because to get the charter for the Stanford Trust here in Baton Rouge, the Louisiana institution, they had to do a background check, and obviously the issues that he had in Montresette came up at that point in time. And our whole argument against OFI relates to the fact that had they barred the sale of the SIB CDs to these IRA accounts, that these group of people that I represent now would have never invested.
Now, did these people you're representing, did they lose for the most part everything? Did they lose part of it? How did that work?
Most of them are not wealthy people, and most of them had IRA accounts, and it varies, okay? Some of them lost everything where they had to sell their house. Some of them lost 50%, but we call it a financial Katrina is what happened, because that's what it was. But they woke up one morning, and what they had anticipated their retirement would be, they didn't have any money to retire.
Well, Stanford had offices in Houston, Memphis, and Tupelo, Mississippi, of all places. And in 2009, the Security Exchange Commission started investigating. He voluntarily surrendered to authorities in June of 2009, and in 2012 was convicted on all charges except one count of wire fraud. He's now serving a 110-year sentence at the U.S. Penitentiary in Coleman, Florida. Looks like he'll live the rest of his years in jail, but he affected these people, and I know it has affected you, because it's hard not to get emotional, people for good reason. In our world, we live in a capitalistic society, and especially if you're at a certain age, you can't just start over, and right. Many of these people have just been, they've gone to the mat, and some of them have died, I'm sure,
yeah,
in the last 15 years.
A third of them all. You know, it's really funny. It's an emotional experience.
Okay.
It really is. Because we know them, and we've seen people that die. We see the financial turmoil that it puts them through. And it's a very, very difficult situation.
Well, it is something that is an American story. We have great stories in this country, and this is the sordid underbelly of what does happen when a capitalistic system is taken advantage of. How did this guy get away with this? How did he devise this scheme and convince so many people that he was on the up and up and was actually helping them?
You know, this is what we call enabling a bad act. In this day and time, you have sophisticated companies, Wall Street firms, that are smart enough not to ask questions. And if they don't know, then under the federal securities law, they can't be convicted. So what they do is they don't ask the questions necessary to perform a due diligence. And I'm going to be honest with you. Until the law in this country changes where you're required to ask those questions and not enable a Ponzi scheme like this, then it's not going to change. You're going to always have people emerge to the top, like in the Bitcoin. It was the same issue. You have people that are making money off these individuals, so they don't ask the hard questions because they want to make money off them.
Well, if you were to win this case, who pays the damages?
In this particular case, the state of Louisiana would be the person that is responsible for paying it. But assuming that we would get a judgment, still the legislature has to approve the funding of it.
And as you stated, most of these people were older, and they thought they were going to have a lavish retirement because the return on investment was incredible. At least on paper, it was incredible.
Well, on paper, it looked like they were making a lot of money, but the money never was paid to them, like the interest. But you know, the interest was only like 7% versus 5%. It wasn't like it was really exorbitant. But they convinced these people, good salesmen, to invest, and they did. And at Exxon, they went out there and they would identify who was retiring, and over and over and over, they convinced these people to
move
their money.
Would they have people come to the plant and make presentations that it would go
that
far?
I don't know that for a fact. Early on, I was hoping I could get Exxon involved in it as a defendant, but we never could figure out the Exxon tie.
But a lot of the people did work for Exxon, and many of them had retired, and they're counting on a certain amount of income for the rest of their lives monthly, and boom, they found out overnight, it's all gone.
That's exactly what happened.
Well, we'll return with Phil Price, one of the best attorneys in Louisiana, the man from Newellton, Louisiana, graduated from LSU in Georgetown, and he is back with more about the Stanford case after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Phil Price is in the house, and he has quite a story to tell, the lead attorney representing how many plaintiffs in the Stanford case?
900 of them. Can you believe that?
900 people, all of whom have a case to make before Judge Don Johnson in the 19th Judicial Court. Next week, the trial begins, jury selection starts, and the state of Louisiana could be on the hook for this, and it involved a lot of entities, and most prominently the owner of the Stanford Group, Mr. Alan Stanford, who's now serving a 110-year sentence, who was on paper a billionaire, but now he doesn't have any resources to pay his victims, does he?
No money.
So really you only have the state as a potential resource. Why is the state culpable? Obviously that's what the case is about.
Well, can you believe this, Jim, that I can't talk about that?
Really?
I mean, it's under a confidentiality order, and we filed a writ yesterday with the Louisiana Supreme Court that gives us the right to make this a public trial. And so the question that is really, it's a top-notch issue in the legal community right now as to whether this will be a public trial or a non-public trial. Up to this point in time, there's been an order in place that the press cannot attend the hearing when we talk about what OFI did wrong.
Now, Stanford, I mentioned there are entities in the United States in the South, but they also were based in Antigua. Did that create some problems as far as going after them and trying to get into their pockets, what was left of them?
Well, not really, because the Stanford Trust, which is the entity that's involved in this, is chartered in Louisiana and is regulated by the state of Louisiana and was regularly examined by OFI. So in this particular case, our theory is pretty limited, and we're just saying that based upon their knowledge of certain conduct prior to 2007, they should have barred the Stanford Trust from purchasing these SIBCDs on behalf of these IRA victims.
Well, about, what, $400 million is at stake, something like that? Is that the figure?
I can't really tell you the number. It's the same issue
same
that
deal,
I have
but,
on
but
the confidentiality, but it's
well,
a large
well,
number.
It's obviously much of this is in the public domain, but victims deposited largely their retirement funds, their so-called nest eggs, into rollover IRA accounts, which were presumably getting enormous interest rates. Why did anybody say, and by the way, I know some lawyers who got caught up in this.
Everybody did.
I mean, some of the most prominent people in Louisiana were victims. Why didn't they say, hey, wait a minute, this is just too good to be true?
Well, you know, Jim, it wasn't like they were making a 20% rate of return. It was a difference on a CD of the difference between 4 to 5% and 7%. It was a 3% mm-hmm. difference. So even though the story that's out there is they were making absorbent interest rates, it's about what you would get right now in the market on mm-hmm. on debt like this.
And this guy Stanford, did he devise this himself, or did he learn from Bernie Madoff and some others who did comparable things?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. The unique thing about this case is that he issued debt instruments mm-hmm. to these people, and they didn't own an interest in his fund.
Now, could he be called as a witness?
Well, he could be, but I don't think anybody wants to call him. I don't think the state wants to call him, and I don't think we need to call him. There's so much written about it, it's really not an issue in the case.
Okay, and Phil has done acquisitions and mergers and things like that involving businesses, so he knows the lay of the land when it comes to businesses on the good side, and in this case, the not-so-good side. But you have a person who's been with you from the start, who you know well, your daughter, Caroline Graham.
That's correct.
Who is a graduate of LSU Law School, and I think went to Boston U undergrad, correct?
That's correct. And she's the one that deals directly with most of the investors.
And you were involved in the Enron case as an attorney, were you not?
Not as an attorney, ancillary right after undergrad. I moved to Washington, D.C. and worked for, on behalf of a third-party defendant in the Enron litigation, right on the cusp of electronic discovery. The multi-district litigation panel of where a lot of cases were consolidated. So is it a really interesting time in securities litigation back in 2002?
I would imagine some of that is applicable to what's going on now.
Seeing and hearing somebody's life change in an instant, waking up and finding out that your retirement fund was gone, very similar to Enron and their executives. Likewise, very similar to our plaintiffs and who we meet with.
Well, Phil, I know a gentleman who told me he lost his life savings on this, and he's a proud man and a tough guy, but he said when he found out he was literally in the fetal position. I mean, that when you're 65, 70 years old and you find out you got nothing, that's not like, well, I'm just going to start over and get back out there and do it again. It's hard to do, isn't it?
Jim, it's not a typical story. You got to realize that all the people here were retirement age. So in 2009, they were 65 years old. And today, all of them are in their 80s. And, you know, the courtroom that they're using is the large courtroom. We're going to have a major group of people there, I can assure you. This is the first civil case that has been tried in Stanford, if you can believe that, to a jury.
And the judge, who's been with us many times, certainly an educated man, we've noted he has 7 degrees, Judge Don Johnson.
Look, Don Johnson is a good judge. What he has done in this case, he's very organized. He's probably one of the most organized judges I've come across in the 40 years that I've practiced. I mean, he keeps track of everything that's going on. He's an engineer by background, and really what he's good at, is electronic computers and the way that we discuss things and we move things either by video or through electronic transmissions. So I could not be any happier with the procedure and the way this case has been handled.
And the lone defendant is the state of Louisiana?
That's correct.
So who will represent the state?
The state is represented by the attorney general, and then the attorney general designates special counsel, and Phelps Dunbar is now the counsel for the attorney general. They're the second law firm. One of the issues we've had in this case is, since it's gone on so long, is the same issues tend to come up over and over because it's a different law firm that's handling the matter now.
Well, how long, or I know how long, but if 15 years is a long time for it to get to court, why did it take so long?
Well, first of all, we had to stay the proceeding when it went to the Supreme Court. Second thing is, Judge Mike Caldwell was a person that handled the initial class certification in 2011. And if you can believe this, his order went up to the First Circuit and was confirmed without any change in it. That order went to the Northern District of Texas into the MDL proceeding. Once again, they confirmed Mike Caldwell's ruling on that. And then the Louisiana Supreme Court did the same thing. Now, Mike has since retired, but he did a great job on the class certification of this case in a very complex situation.
Are you confident?
Say that again.
Are you confident that the outcome will be appropriate?
Yep.
You've been at this a long time. As you stated when you got this, I know you had a full plate, and this is the kind of thing that can overwhelm a law firm.
The facts, assuming that they're able to come out to the public, are overwhelming in favor of the victim.
Well, it's just a matter, I think, based on what I know, you've got a good case, but is the state culpable? And that's what you can't talk about, but you'll be making that case a week from today. How long do you think the trial will last?
It's 2 weeks, is what it is.
Got to do it in 2 weeks.
That's right. And it's bifurcated, which is somewhat unusual. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you divide it up into the liability section, then you do the damages section.
Well, it's kind of the culmination of a brilliant law career for you, but I don't think you anticipated it happening quite like this.
Oh, no.
No. No, but you're personally involved in this one, too. And after a while, you get a bit jaded, but I can tell. It's taken some starch out of you, Phil.
Well,
I think that one thing that continually inspires them is working for our clients and hearing their story. And while it was devastating to see their hope and resilience and endurance over the past 15 years, and if that's the story that he's able to tell, I think it's one worth telling.
Well, thank you, Caroline Graham, Phil Price. We'll see what happens. We'll follow it, and we'll talk more about it in the days to come. This is Jim Inkster, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana, and it's quite a treat to catch up with Jan Risher, columnist and feature writer for The Advocate and Picayune, newspaper of record in our state. And she came this way 2.5 years, leaving private business after a long career as a journalist, and she is now the preeminent voice and wordsmith when it comes to culture in our community. And she, I guess, inherits that title from one Smiley Gray Anders Jr., who died on the 31st of May. And Smiley Anders gave us 86 and a half great years. And Jan eulogized him quite profoundly a few weeks ago. And you caught the magic of the man we knew as Smiley and loved him so immensely. I don't know of anybody who was embraced by a community more than Smiley Anders was by Baton Rouge, Jan.
I don't either. I really don't. I'm almost speechless when it comes to trying to explain how much people loved him. They really did.
They did. And he was a guy who was effusively optimistic, enthusiastic. He had his opinions, but people didn't hold them against him, and nor that should they have, because he was not a malicious man at all. But back in the day, before he started writing his 6-day-a-week column, he was a reviewer, and you caught some of his journalistic ability. He reviewed the second-to-last concert ever for Elvis Aaron Presley, who on May 31st, 1977, ironically, exactly 47 years to the day before Smiley Anders died, when Smiley in 1977 was a young lad of 29, he reviewed Elvis's concert at the LSU Assembly Center. Elvis, as we know, was 2.5 months from the end at 42 years old. Crowd of 12,000 fans showed up, and Smiley gave it a thumbs down, didn't he?
He did, and he told me, even just in probably weeks before he died, that the grief he got for this review of Elvis's concert was some of the worst he ever got, particularly from his ex-wife, one of his ex-wives.
Well, people loved Elvis, and some people who were older, they couldn't accept the fact that he had lost several steps. But Smiley caught it. Do you have the part you read at his celebration of life? Because it definitely,
I did.
It was vintage Smiley. And did he ever, if you talk about a prediction for a man who was nearing the end, Smiley caught it.
Yeah. He called it like it was. And he said that an Elvis concert is a rite of spring, a pagan worship ceremony, a ritual for those bent on recapturing lost youth. And the concert has the same unvarying quality of a religious ceremony, where tradition forbids any tampering with the ritual. The warm-up band, the girl singers, the comedian, Elvis himself in this white suit and spangles and scarves, even the audience are the same from year to year. And he keeps going, and he said some beautiful things about the...
He reminds us of Johnny Unitas and
that
Willie
part,
Mays.
Yes, yeah. But watching him in that white suit trying to do a split is a sad experience, very much like watching Johnny Unitas during his last heartbreaking year with the San Diego Chargers. And the feeling you get is the same. Damn it, you were the best. Don't cheapen our memories.
That's great. And it caught it. And Elvis on the 16th day of August, 1977, as Rush Limbaugh would say, assumed room temperature in Memphis, Tennessee. I bet you've been to Graceland a few times.
I have.
Graceland's your kind of place, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Have you been?
I have never been, and I grew up in Little Rock, so I wasn't far away, but you're a daughter of Mississippi.
I am a daughter of Mississippi. I've even been to Elvis's birthplace in Tupelo. My mother actually lives just outside of Memphis now. And she loves Elvis. In fact, the only argument she ever got in with my husband was whether or not Elvis went to heaven.
Well, there's some who believe he's not dead.
Well, that is true.
That's right. Elvis, if he is alive, he's going to be 90 years old on the 8th day of January. And Elvis, if you're out there, give us a call at 877-217-5757. But I think he's gone. I think he has left the building.
I think that Smiley, there was some serious foreshadowing of that back on May 31st, 1977, that Elvis's time was nigh.
Well, Elvis in his day was exceptional, but the irony is that he only had about 20 years on the world scene, and he made an imprint that is everlasting, no doubt. As did Smiley, and Jan Rischer is doing the same. I was honored to be one of her interview subjects, and I think the first one you did was Smiley Anders, wasn't it?
Actually, the first one that I did was Deborah Sternberg, and Smiley, I think, was number two.
Well, Deborah's doing great work,
yeah.
And she's from a famous Baton Rouge family, but Smiley chose to go to the pastime, didn't he?
That's his place.
That was his spot.
Mm-hmm. He even got married there.
Did he really?
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that. To Lady Catherine?
To Lady Catherine.
Now, he was married a few times.
He was. To Lady Catherine.
He did an interview with us a few days before he died that was to be taped, and it turned out to be prophetic. It was to be taped for airplay on his anniversary as a columnist, which was June 4th, 1979. He did it right, I think he did it like a day before he died, and he noted that he had kissed a few frogs until he found Lady Catherine. Now, only Smiley could say that.
Yeah, and they had such a great and wonderful relationship. I was just so privileged to be able to spend time with them. He and Lady Catherine hosted a going-away party for our daughter who graduated from LSU on May the 19th.
And 12 days before
12 days before he died.
Before he died in Spanish Town, which is apropos. That was a neighborhood made for Smiley Gray Anders Jr. But Jan Rischer took this town by storm when she arrived 2.5 years ago, and she is doing different things, and she writes columns. And one that I chose to accent in our time with her today, 23 words the cool kids know. What are some of the good words that cool kids know?
Well, Riz was, you know, the 2023 word of the year.
Right.
Short for charisma. So I started the
column. She's got Riz. You've got Riz, Jan.
My nephew Sam is the one who really has serious Riz. They call him the Rizzler.
What does sus mean?
Sus is short for suspect. I am, by the way, no total expert on these words, but I loved doing the research. Talking to teen and preteen boys about all these words was some of the most fun I've had in a long time.
And if somebody says, you ate, A-T-E.
Meaning, you looking good, you did a good job.
Really?
That's right. You
really?
Ate, Jim.
Well, that's
Angster.
A compliment.
That's right.
Well, this is wonderful, and what you're doing is wonderful. We need people like you writing for the local newspaper, and you're moving into a new realm with health. Right now, you're covering people who are of renown in our community, and perhaps some people who are infamous as well, but you also are writing about spiritual matters. You're in the Inspired section every Sunday.
I'm the editor of the Inspired section, and that section I adore because it is all about good stuff, people looking for solutions, and that's what we try to focus on in that section.
And you're going to take your abilities to opine on different matters to the health realm. What's going on there?
We will have a new health section that will launch on July the 28th, and I'm working with a new she's been in the paper for more than a year, but her name is Margaret Delaney, and she will be coordinating the section, and we'll be putting that out every week, really taking a deep dive into what's going on with health and the health industry.
You've got health, you've got the higher authority, and you've got interesting people, so anybody is fair game for Jan Rischer, who's doing wonderful work at The Advocate. Her column, long story short, runs every Sunday in The Advocate. And we're really pleased that you have gotten ingrained enough to give us a glimpse of Smiley Gray Anders we did not have. But do you like, you lived in Lafayette a long time. There's kind of a difference, and some people in Lafayette don't like the difference, and some people in Baton Rouge don't either. But these are two great cities, and you managed to do well in both.
I loved living in Lafayette, but I have loved living in Baton Rouge. And one of the things I think is so interesting is, even if you think about the difference of New Orleans and Lafayette and how the people who live in those places talk about those places and how much they love, you know, you are Lafayette proud, you are New Orleans proud. I don't get the sense mm-hmm. of that as much with Baton Rouge. And I think there's so many reasons to be Baton Rouge proud. And I don't mean to sound mm-hmm. like the Chamber of Commerce, but I really do love living here.
And Robin, our producer, notes that you caught in all her glory Trina Edwards. You've written some captivating pieces about her. And as far as clickbait, I understand she's gotten more views than anybody else you've ever written about, Jan Risher.
Maybe so. That Trina is one interesting girl. She entertains the heck out of me. She really does. She's an interesting person. She's a very smart person.
Well, her former husband, Edwin Washington Edwards, the legendary four-term governor of Louisiana, the three-year anniversary of his death was on Friday, and she is now married to his best friend, John Alario, the former Speaker of the House, President of the Senate. They seem to be doing well. Those two crazy kids seem to be going at it well. And
redoing a house in Gretna?
Yeah. And John will be 81 in September, and Trina in August, I think she was born in 78, so she'll be 46. That's perfect, right?
It works for them well.
It works for them well, and she is somebody who does not shy away from being unconventional, does she? That's part of the magic.
Part of the appeal, and you know, I cheer for people who are willing to live their own lives.
To be an individual. Society often punishes individuals, but in this case, at least with Jan Risher's treatment, society, I think, has embraced Trina, and I wouldn't be surprised that she makes the news in some way, shape, or form sometime soon and very soon. So,
do you know something, Jim?
No, I wouldn't be surprised, for example, that she might run for office. I think that might be a possibility.
Wow.
Yeah, but she says no. And I suspect John would say, I don't think that's a good idea. But chances are she also will outlive her third husband, too. So we'll see. But we'll follow it with you. Keep up your good work. Always great to see Jan Risher of The Advocate. And until next segment, we're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing. And we round the corner and head for home with Ann Arsenault. Fascinating lady from New Orleans who spent much of her career as an accountant, but in the last several years has become an accomplished writer. And she's here to talk a bit about her third book, but she has an interesting backstory, to say the least. And I know people who are good with numbers quite often don't evolve into writers, but you've done it and done it well. How did that process begin for you, Ann?
The writing process?
Yes.
The writing process started as a child. I used to write all of my thoughts. I've always journaled. I did some poetry, and as an adult, I decided that I would start writing stories. Stories related to things that have happened to me and stories that have come from other people's experiences that I thought were pretty fascinating.
Well, her latest work is Pecan Chi, a novel that navigates us into the culture of Louisiana from the inception of a family on its pecan grove and plantation, and the reader is lured into the weave of this story with the main character, Lillian Blosch, right? Tell us about Lillian.
Lillian is kind of spunky, and she is a little bit odd based on the culture that she grew up in. She wants to divert from it because she has all these aspirations. And one of the aspirations is to become a dancer. Mm-hmm. And she wants to be a dancer in New York. But in order to do that, she has to go against her culture. And so she passes for white. And that is just the start of it. It grows into a lot of chaos that comes from just that one decision. That one decision causes her to have other decisions that are poor decisions. And then an ultimate decision that ruined a lot for her.
Well, she has her parents die when she's what?
16 years old.
So that would change anybody's life, and then has this voyage in which she changes her identity, and it's a captivating setup. And in Louisiana, we have different hues of people, as we know, and some people who are white sometimes pass for black, and some people who are black pass for white. And you can relate to that a little bit, can't you?
Not personally, but I have relatives who probably can a lot more than I can.
So how does it affect Lillian, and how does she pull this off?
So she pulls it off because she definitely looks like she is, and she marries a guy who is, and her children look like they are for the most part. And I can't give too much of the story away, but it causes her some problems during the civil rights era.
Well, and we live in a state and a region, and I guess a country that's confounded by race. It's not an easy thing to address. And for someone who's grown up in Louisiana, I would imagine some of this was challenging to write.
It was. In fact, the decisions that she made seem like she would anger some people. In fact, a lot of my readers have come back to me and said, you know, would you have done what she did? And I said, well, I can't do what she did. But in the story, if you keep reading, there is an explanation. And at the end, you sort of start feeling sorry for her, because it does get into her head, and you get to see it from her perspective, why she made the choices that she did, and the outcomes weren't the way that, you know, I guess she would have liked them to be, but in the end, it worked out for her.
We're hearing the voice of Anne Arsenault. Her book is Pecan Chi, and it's about a family in Louisiana. It goes back a little ways, like a few centuries, this story
does. It starts in 1700s, but that's just to set up how this all came about, and then it picks up in the 1960s. Where Lillian chooses to make this decision. And it gives you lots of history. It talks about things that happened in the civil rights era. It talks about some of the history of how people, the culture of Louisiana developed. And you get involved in the history of it, and it sort of makes sense why she did what she did.
This is your third book. And as I noted, you started writing after having a different kind of career. You told us you started writing when you were a kid, but when did you realize that, hey, I want to pursue this full time?
Probably when I was in my 30s.
Mm-hmm. And I can tell you're not a flamboyant person, but you reveal things on paper and in your books that you probably wouldn't anywhere else, don't you?
That's true.
And you wrote about something very personal in a previous book.
Yes, I did.
How was that experience?
It was cathartic, to say the least. It helped me relive through different eyes. So when you're going through something, and in this case, a divorce and that sort of thing, when you're going through something, you see it one way. But after you've healed from it, you get to see it in a different light. And when you're writing about it, it really heals you even more, and it gives you a different perspective in a way that can help other people.
How was the response not only from your family, but from others who read your work and said, I didn't know anything about this. I didn't know this was in Anne.
There was one person actually this week who said, there's an audio version of that particular book, and he read it and he said, I wish that I could have, it was an old friend from my childhood. He said, I wish I could have given you a hug.
The book, Acrimony, Passion, and Peace, right?
Yes.
That was your second book.
That was my second book.
Okay, and the first one was another one perhaps you might not expect from what we just heard, a different kind of book, but it another story that you found in your imagination. What was the backdrop for A Horse Named Toonie?
A Horse Named Toonie was, that started because I have a friend who's an author, and I edited two of his books. And I showed him some of my work, and a lot of it was poetry. And he said, you know, you really should start each chapter of your book with a poem. So I woke up one morning with a poem in my head, but it was too big. And so I turned it into a children's book. And Toonie, the horse, actually does make a cameo in Pecan Chi.
And it is a book that is out and about, available through Amazon, right?
Through Amazon.
And I know you've had some book signings. The next one's in New Orleans, right?
Yes, it is, at Vaucresson's Creole Cafe at 1800 St. Bernard Avenue. And you can come out.
When is it?
It is July 27th. You can enjoy the book signing and some of Chef Bunny's food and some of that great Vaucresson sausage.
So that's 12 days from now. And Anne Arsenault will be there. That's a Saturday, right?
That is a Saturday.
Saturday. Originally from New Orleans, how much did that experience affect your life and your art?
Well, I mean, when you grow up somewhere, everything that is involved in the culture becomes a part of you. And I have been in contact with other people who have actually done what Lillian did. There were people who moved to different states, California, one of them. And they actually did what Lillian did and made some of the choices that Lillian made.
Well, Lillian sounds like she might have some of the same qualities you have.
In what way?
Well, I would think that part of you is in Lillian and part of Lillian is in you.
Okay.
All right. But it's a personal story. And tell us about... your imagination taking this course to the point where you've got a person passing for a different race. I remember when I was a kid, I read a book called Black Like Me, which affected me immensely. You probably read the same book. Yeah. This is a story that perhaps is as old as our country, but at the same time, we don't read stories like this much anymore.
We don't. And I know on social media, there's a lot going on about... particularly on TikTok, there are two women that I know, and they present as white. They look like they're white, but they don't pass for white. And so people comment, you're white. You should be white. And they're not, you know, and this is a conversation that is going on right now. But as far as Lillian goes, it was a time during the civil rights era, and she goes through all these emotions, and you get to experience all these things with her, why she did what she did and why we don't do it now, or not we, me, but other, you know, fair, very fair blacks, why they don't do it now. It's because we were shamed for that sort of thing, and now they're saying we should do it. It just doesn't make sense in my mind. But at the time when Lillian was doing it, it was a necessity for her to pursue the dream that she wanted. It just backfired in her face a little bit.
Yeah. I think I'm close to a decade older than you, but you've experienced what happens in our country, in our state, and in New Orleans. How have we evolved over that, over the course of your life?
Honestly, I feel like there was an evolution in the 80s and the 90s, but I think it has kind of turned backwards a little bit in a few ways.
Well, we'll see where it goes, but your book is a contribution to the discussion. It's called Pecan Chi, like Tai Chi, C-H-I, from Anne Arsenault, available through Amazon. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay safe and stay tuned.